From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Actor Walter Huston, film director John Huston, and actress Angelica Huston represent three generations of the same family. The Huston family is the subject of a new biography by Lawrence Grobel. On today's Fresh Air, Grobel shares some stories behind their films, from The Maltese Falcon to Pritzi's Honor. We also meet Chris Difford and Glenn Tilbrook from the pop group Squeeze. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews reissues of works by composer Eric Wolfgang Korngold. The recordings include some classic film scores. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg reads book jacket blurbs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. It's not over yet in Virginia. Republican Marshall Coleman said today he'll ask for a recount in yesterday's gubernatorial election, the closest governor's race in Virginia history. But Democrat Douglas Wilder has already claimed victory on the strength of his unofficial lead of some 5,000 votes. In New York City, David Dinkins went to City Hall today, where he will soon take office as the first black mayor of the nation's largest city. In New Jersey, Democratic Representative James Florio celebrated his personal victory as governor after two previous gubernatorial campaign defeats. Democrats rejoiced at regaining the state's top job after 8 years, as well as control of both houses in the state legislature. That assures them the upper hand when the state's congressional districts are reapportioned after the 1990 census. The Senate today passed a minimum wage law that would boost pay for the poorest paid Americans for the first time since 1981. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
The minimum wage bill passed the Senate this afternoon 89-8. The bill was the result of a compromise between the White House and congressional Democrats. It allows the minimum wage to go up to $4.25 an hour in 2 years. And it introduces a new lower training wage, 85% of the minimum, that can be paid to teenage workers during their first 90 days of employment. The House has already passed the minimum wage bill. President Bush has said he will sign it. The bill doesn't make up for inflation, however. If it had, the new minimum would now be close to $4.60 an hour. Nor does the new minimum enable a full-time worker to keep a family of three above the poverty line. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Nicaraguan opposition candidate Violeta Chamorro met with President Bush today to drum up support for her campaign for the presidency of Nicaragua. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mrs. Chamorro is the publisher of the opposition newspaper La Prensa. She was chosen to run against President Daniel Ortega because she is widely considered the only person who could unify the various factions of the Nicaraguan civilian opposition. Today in Washington, she urged her supporters to keep their attention focused on the election scheduled for February 1990. She also denied having received any of the $9 million Congress has approved for her campaign. Mrs. Chamorro also said she hopes that the peace talks that begin tomorrow between the government and the Contras will lead to a permanent peace. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
A passenger ferry bound for England from Hamburg, West Germany, has collided with a container ship. Police say there are deaths and injuries. Harbor police say the passenger ferry Hamburg collided with the container ship Nordic Stream on the North Sea. There is no immediate word on the number of killed or injured. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 26 points today to close at 2623.36. Advances led declines 5-2. This is NPR News. The East German Communist Party today reshuffled its leadership, bringing in at least one well-known reformer, and there appears to be moves underway to legalize West Germany's vast opposition. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from East Berlin.
Just as the three-day meeting of the Central Committee got underway this morning, it was announced that the entire Politburo of the Communist Party had resigned. In its place, the party tonight has a new, smaller, and younger Politburo. One of its new members is Hans Modrow, the chief of the Communist Party in the city of Dresden, and the party leader who has most publicly shown a commitment to reform. Modrow has also been named prime minister of the government. In that position, he must be confirmed by the nation's parliament. A party spokesman also said the Central Committee is considering a new election law that could permit opposition parties to run in future elections. And the government announced tonight that it is taking steps to legalize East Germany's largest opposition group, New Forum. I'm Mike Schuster in East Berlin.
The government said today it will press for forced mergers between struggling savings and loans and stronger competitors to build a smaller but healthier thrift industry. The director of the Office of Thrift Supervision, M. Danny Wall, said his agency would use the threat of penalties against thrifts to arrange mergers with potential suitors. The forced mergers would apply to SNLs that fall short of tough new capital requirements issued by the office this week. The Pentagon said today that automatic budget cuts would force the Defense Department to reduce the nation's armed forces by about 229,000 troops. Democrats who attended the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing on the impact of the Graham-Rudman law said they're surprised that President Bush seems ready to allow such severe cutbacks. Bush has said he could live with the cutbacks in fiscal 1990 rather than accept a budget reconciliation bill that does not result in real deficit reductions. The administration wants $14 billion in cuts. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When film director John Huston died 2 years ago, he left behind a legacy of classic films such as The Maltese Falcon, The African Queen, Key Largo, The Asphalt Jungle, and The Misfits. Pritzi's Honor and The Dead were among his last films. They both starred his daughter, Angelica. John Huston directed his father, Walter, in the 1948 film Treasure of the Sierra Madre. The Huston family is the subject of a new biography by Lawrence Grobel, who's best known for his Playboy magazine interviews. In fact, Grobel interviewed John Huston for Playboy in 1984, 2 years before beginning his book, The Hustons. Grobel spent 100 hours with Huston and was on the set during the shooting of The Dead. Grobel also interviewed Huston's children, several of his ex-wives, and many actors who were directed by him, including Katharine Hepburn. John Huston got his start writing screenplays. When Warner Brothers offered him the chance to direct the film, he chose to adapt Dashiell Hammett's book, The Maltese Falcon.
The book always interested him. He liked Dashiell Hammett. He liked the writing. He liked the idea. He thought that he could handle this kind of a film. One of the things also about that film was that the studio, Warner Brothers, owned The Maltese Falcon because they had shot it twice before earlier, and neither one really worked. So they were kind of happy in a sense that they that John wanted to do this one because they had it. They didn't have to buy it again, and they thought they could give him a shot at it. George Raft, who was originally going to star in it, didn't want to do it because he said, "I don't want to work with a first-time director." So he dropped out, and that's when John was pleased because he got to get Bogart. And then he got to cast Sidney Greenstreet, who had never acted in a film before. You know, he knew what he wanted. He had Peter Lorre and of course, Mary Astor. And he put that together. And I think John's genius was in his casting. He knew how to create the actors and match them to the parts. And that way he could sort of leave them alone.
Well, you have a story about the very last line of this film, and I thought I'd play the scene, the very end scene, and then ask you about the story of the last line. And this is
sure.
After Bogart's kind of solved the mystery of the Maltese Falcon, the cops come, and they're wondering what was the Maltese Falcon really made of and why was there such lusting after it.
Come in. Hello, Tom. Got him?
Got him.
Swell. Here's another one for you. She killed Miles. Oh, and I've got some exhibits. The boy's guns, one of Cairo's, and $1,000 bill I was supposed to be bribed with. And this black statuette here that all the fuss was about.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Huh?
What is it, the stuff that dreams are made of? What's the story behind those last words of the film?
Well, that was not in Dashiell Hammett's book, and John was credited with the screenplay, and for until really just recently, everyone thought that he wrote those lines. And it may be the most famous lines in any of his films, along with badges. We don't need no stinking badges from Treasure. But he told me when we were talking about this film, just right before he died, he said, you know, this will be in a way of a revelation, Larry. He says, but the last line to the Maltese Falcon, he says, I didn't do it. He said, what happened is the day they were going to shoot that scene, Bogart came up to him and said, John, I have an idea. And he says, what do you think if I say the stuff that dreams are made of? You think that's any good, John? And John said, I think it's very good, Bogey, very good indeed. Indeed it was.
My guest is Lawrence Grobel, and he's the author of the new book, The Eustons, which is a biography of film director and writer John Huston, his father, the actor Walter Huston, and John Huston's daughter, the actress Angelica Huston. Now, John Huston directed his father, Walter Huston, in the film, the 1948 film, Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Right.
Let's listen to a scene with his father in it, then you could tell us how they came to make this movie together. And this is a scene about gold and greed.
You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking we ought to give up. Leave the whole outfit. Everything behind and go back to civilization.
What's that you say? Go back? Ha-ha! Well, tell my old grandmother. I got two very elegant bedfellows who kick at the first drop of rain and hide in the closet from thunder rumbles. My, what great prospectors. Two shoe clerks reading the magazine about prospecting for gold in the land in the midnight sun, south of the border, west of the Rockies.
That's your trap. Shut up, or I'll smash your head flat.
Go ahead. Throw it. If you did, you'd never leave this wilderness alive. Without me, you two would die here more miserable than rats.
I'll leave him alone.
Can't you see the old man's nuts?
Nuts! Nuts, am I? Let me tell you something, my two fine bedfellows. You're so dumb, there's nothing to compare you with. You're dumber than the dumbest jackass. Look at each other, will you? Do you ever see anything like yourself for being dumb specimens? You're so dumb, you don't even see the riches you're treading on with your own feet. Yeah, I don't expect to find nuggets of molten gold. It's rich, but not that rich. And here ain't the place to dig. It comes from someplace further up. Up there. Up there's where we got to go. Up there.
A scene from Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and I should mention that John Huston won two Academy Awards for that, both for Best Direction and Best Screenplay, and his father, Walter Huston, who played the old-timer, won as Best Supporting Actor. How did they get to work together, the two Hustons, on that film?
Well, Walter, who was already a very big star by then, always said to John, "Find me a part for your old man. You know, find me a good part." And so he was always looking, John, and he always wanted to do this film. And when he got in touch with B. Travin and said that he wanted to cast through letters, this is Walter in this, he said, no, Walter's not old enough. He wanted Lewis Calhern. But John then got Walter. He says, well, I can make him work. And that's why he got Walter to take out his teeth, which Louis B. Mayer said was never able to forgive John for. He says, how could you do that to your father, make him take his teeth out? But, of course, that helped.
When you say teeth, were they dentures, or did he have them surgically
dentures,
removed?
Right.
Okay.
At that particular scene, which is a very famous scene, John didn't know he was going to do that. Walter had said to him, listen, just let the cameras roll. I've got an idea, and don't call cut. So he does this jig, a jig that he learned from Eugene O'Neill in Desire Under the Elms. He does that maniacal laugh and that speedy talk, which he learned from his sister Margaret, who really taught Walter how to play a lot of these parts, especially early in his career. And he did this scene, and Bogart was off to the side, and he watched it, and he was saying, he mumbled something to the effect that working with one Huston is bad enough, working with two is murder, because he saw right there that Walter Huston just stole the film from him and was going to make it memorable, and he did.
Well, moving along in John Huston's career, let's talk about the 1948 film Key Largo. And this is a film about a gangster holding people captive in a Florida hotel. I want to play what's really... It's probably one of the most famous scenes from the film. It's my favorite scene from the film. And this is where Edward G. Robinson and Claire Trevor are in the scene. She's an alcoholic, and she's begging him for a drink. And he says, well, sing, moan and low. Sing a song, and he'll give her the drink. And then he wants her to sing the song that she used to always sing when she was a nightclub singer. So this is the scene where she sings that song.
Well, go ahead, sing.
Moaning low, My sweet man is gonna go. When he goes, oh Lordy, he's the kind of man needs the kind of woman like me. Oh, give me that drink now, Johnny.
No.
Johnny.
No.
But you promised.
So what?
You said that.
But you were right.
Cruel and humiliating. Well, there's an interesting story behind how John Huston directed Claire Trevor in that scene.
Yes, I saw Claire Trevor in New York, and she told me that she was very afraid of the scene. She didn't know she didn't consider herself a singer. She wanted to rehearse the scene, and every day she would go to John and say, "John, can we rehearse that scene? Can I do the song for you? I need to know how I'm supposed to move." And he'd say, "Don't worry, Claire. We have plenty of time. We have plenty of time. We won't shoot that for another few weeks. Don't worry." And then one day, John said, "Okay, we're going to do the song now." And Claire was mortified. "How can we do this? I've never rehearsed it." And John said, "Don't worry, Claire. Just get up and sing." And that's the performance she gave. And he wanted her to be rotten. He wanted her to be nervous. He wanted her to be the alcoholic ex-singer who was down and out on her luck. And he got that performance. And off to the side, a few of the actors, including Harry Lewis, who was one of the bad guys in the movie, whispered, "You know, she's going to win the Academy Award because of that." And sure enough, she did.
Yeah, he wanted her to be really unprepared.
Yes. I mean, when John saw or, you know, knew the kind of character he wanted, he didn't necessarily want to over-prepare an actor or to even talk to him. He liked to keep them on the edge. And he did that time and time again, and I think it really worked effectively in a number of his films.
My guest is Lawrence Grobel, the author of a new book called The Hustons. That's about film director and screenwriter John Huston, his father Walter Huston, and John Huston's daughter Angelica Huston. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Lawrence Grobel is my guest, and we're talking about his new book, The Hustons. Let me ask you about one of his most famous films, which is The African Queen. There is, I believe, a whole book written about the making of that movie. Well, the film, The African Queen, was shot on location.
Right.
And there were a lot of problems they ran into shooting on location.
There were enormous problems. John went hunting one day with Katharine Hepburn, and they were charged by elephants. A wild boar almost got her. There were ants that attacked them, and they had to keep their beds and the bedposts and all and the legs in kerosene, so they couldn't go up on the bed. They finally had to move locations, set fire to areas. The African Queen itself sunk. But there were enormous problems continuously, but everybody was on edge about it, and people got dysentery. Katharine Hepburn got very sick for over a week. But John, you know, drank his booze with Bogey. He never drank the water, and had a ball. That was really the first of the jet set, directors, John, going to Africa in 1950-51 to make the film instead of being on a studio lot.
Yeah, Huston told you that this is one of the few movies he'd enjoy reliving. Given all the disasters that happened, it's hard to imagine what made him have such a great time.
Well, that was John's element. I mean, if he could, the further away he could get from civilization, the more difficult the area that they could shoot in. I mean, he even discovered that river by going over in a plane, the River Ruiki, and he dropped a handkerchief from the plane and said, "That's where we'll shoot." And one of his crew members actually found that handkerchief. So, I mean, it was fascinating with John, but did the same thing with A Man Who Would Be King. If he could find strange locations, if he could go to Tobago to shoot Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, he'd go there. He didn't like to shoot scenes, movies on lots. Night of the Iguana, Ms. Maloya Beach, Puerto Vallarta, he really discovered that place.
John Huston has been praised for the way his movies have been cast, but there's one movie in particular in which the casting was really called into question, and I'm referring to Gregory Peck, who starred as Captain Ahab in the 1956 film version
right.
of
Moby
Dick. It
came out in 56, right.
Yeah, let me play an excerpt from this movie.
All you mastheaders, now hear me. You're to look for a white whale. A whale as white and as big as a mountain of snow. Aye, like corkscrews, he's struck full of harpoons, man. And his spout is a big one like a whole shock of wheat. And he fantails like a broken jib in a storm. Death, men, you've seen him. It's Moby Dick.
Captain Ahab, was it not Moby Dick took off thy leg?
Aye. It was Moby Dick that tore my soul and body until they bled into each other.
Why was Gregory Peck so criticized in that role, and why did John Huston defend his choice?
Well, Peck was criticized because they said he looked like Abraham Lincoln. He didn't look obsessed enough or crazed enough. And a lot of people, especially all the crew members, thought that the real person who should have played Captain Ahab was John, because John, you know, behaved very much like Ahab during the making of this. But John defended Peck all the time. He thought he was cast right. He said he seldom looked at his movies a second time, but he did see Moby Dick again on television, and he told me that he was unbudged regarding Peck's performance. He said there was a kind of massive dignity that he had, and the speech that he gives to Starbuck, where he goes, "It's a vile, vile day." He said, "My God, the voice is just right." Where John faults the film more was seeing the ending of Moby Dick, and then having seen Jaws, Steven Spielberg's film, he saw how magnificent and how the way the shark was done, and the teeth on Jaws and everything. And he said, "I didn't have enough teeth in my whale. I didn't have enough movement." And I said to John, "The technology didn't exist then to do what you wanted to do." And he said, "That's not the point." He says, "I should have invented it, you know. And if he could have had another shot at some of his films, he'd like to have redone the ending of Moby Dick and make it more powerful."
Lawrence Grobel is my guest, and his new book, The Hustons, is a family biography. Let's jump ahead a little bit and talk about how John Huston started working with his daughter, the actress Angelica Huston. And two of her most acclaimed performances were in films directed by her father, Pritzi's Honor and The Dead. But the first time they worked together was a film that very few people have seen, I think.
Mm-hmm.
A film called A Walk with Love and Death that came out in, I think it was 1969.
Right.
Now, how did they first work together in this film?
Well, she was 15 years old. She had just read for Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, and she was one of three contenders to be in that, and she really wanted to do that. But John felt he hadn't really been close with either of his children. He grew up a bit distance from them. He was never around during their growing up, and he wanted to do something
for... Well, he was long divorced from Angelica's mother, right?
He wasn't divorced. They were separated.
Oh,
they
okay.
never divorced. But he finally got her. He told her he's going to do A Walk with Love and Death. Ricky, her mother, was against it because she had to go out of school to do it. And right before they were going to shoot it, Angelica cut her hair short. Now, she's playing a 14th century maiden, and she's supposed to have long hair, and they had to go get some props from the Bible to some wigs for her. And John never could understand that behavior. He couldn't understand why she was crying all the time. He couldn't understand why if Katharine Hepburn could take direction from him, his own daughter wouldn't. And it was just a difficult time, and she was very unhappy throughout it. But the film came out, and then her mother died, and then she has to go to the States and start promoting it. It was a very difficult time for her, and she didn't want to act after that for a long time. She became a model. She then started doing some small parts in movies after meeting Nicholson and being with him in 72 and 73. And it wasn't until really Pritzi's Honor, 1985, which came out, they shot it in 84, that she came into her own, she realized she had a reconciliation with her father. She realized that the best way for them to get along was for them to work together. And she really pulled that one off and, of course, won the Oscar. And then she did The Dead, which Tony, his son, wrote and got a nomination for writing it. I think that solidified Angelica as the next Huston down the line with those two performances.
You haven't gotten back in touch with Angelica Houston and spoken to her about a performance in Woody Allen's new film, have you?
Yes, actually, I did. I spoke with Angelica about a week and a half ago before she went off to do The Grifters, this latest film she's in. And I hadn't yet seen it. I have since. But I told her, I've been reading about it. I said, boy, you certainly have you're getting a lot of good notices about this. And she says, well, it's definitely a one-note movie, she says, for me. It's a lot of shrieking and a lot of yelling and, and a lot of harping at his character. And she, of course, ends up getting killed in this movie of Woody Allen's, which is a departure for him as well. She was very pleased with it. She really wanted to work with Woody Allen, and she felt it was a major thing in her life to have done that.
John Huston was known as quite a womanizer, and he had affairs with many women in Hollywood and many women who worked on his movies. How did that affect his reputation in Hollywood?
Well, things weren't blasted the way they are today in the tabloids, and you could have a life that was a bit wild, and it wasn't always out there. But John was so wild at times that he went out with John Houseman's wife, Zita Johann. He was drunk and got into a car accident. She went through the windshield in 1932. In 1933, he was with he ran over a woman and had a big problem there and had to leave the country. So I was very fortunate that I was able to talk to many of these people, the mistresses, the three living wives, the people who called him the most prolific man sexually they ever met. There was no one like him except perhaps Lucifer. These are the kind of remarks you got. And yet they all talked about him, and they all had stories about him, and he was a central figure in many of their lives. So he was quite a man.
John Huston was very productive at the end of his life and made several movies that he'll probably always be remembered for: The Dead, Pritzi's Honor, Wise Blood.
Under the Volcano, right?
Were you able to talk to him about why he seemed to be so driven toward the end of his life, at an age when most directors have long retired?
Well, John never believed in a hereafter. It was only one life, and that was the life you live. And he believed that he always said, if I'm bored, I run from boredom like a hare. So I think that John just did what he could do, and if he could make movies, he would make them right up until the end, which of course is what he did.
I want to ask you about Chinatown, in which John Huston had a small role. It's a wonderful performance, and in this movie directed by Roman Polanski. Huston plays someone who we find out at the end of the movie has had an incestuous relationship with his daughter and then ends up having custody over her. And it's a really scary, chilling role. How did he get the role, and how did he feel about taking it?
Well, Roman Polanski, I saw him in Paris as well, and I talked to him, and he said he always had John Huston in mind for this part. He says, he says, I know that kind of guy. He's a kind of a cowboy. He's a womanizer. He's an all-powerful kind of character. And he says, he's a bit of a bastard as well. And John, it seemed to me that everything he had read about John Huston was who he was. So he went to convince John about doing it. And of course, John never took acting that seriously. He always said there was one actor in my family, and that was Walter. And of course, I think he would at the end say Angelica as well. But he did a lot of those things for the money. He was always in debt and gambling and whatever. And because he was very generous with his life, he always was spending money. So acting was a way of making money when he wasn't directing a film. When this part came along and he got to do it with Nicholson, be with Nicholson and watch Polanski, it was interesting to him. And he played that very chillingly. And it's a marvelous part. I think he holds up. I think he steals the scenes whenever he is in with Nicholson. And it's quite a tribute to him to be able to have done that.
Lawrence Grobel, thanks a lot for talking with us about the Hustons.
Well, thank you very much.
Lawrence Grobel's new book, The Hustons, is published by Scribner's. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, biologist and science writer Stephen Jay Gould updates the theory of evolution. I hope you can join us. This is John Huston and Jack Nicholson in a scene from Chinatown.
You may think you know what you're dealing with, but believe me, you don't. Why is that funny?
It's what the district attorney used to tell me in Chinatown.
Yeah? Exactly what do you know about me?
Mainly that you're rich and too respectable to want your name in the newspapers.
Of course I'm respectable. I'm old. Politicians, ugly buildings, and whores all get respectable if they last long enough.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reacquaints us with the classic movie themes of Erich Wolfgang Korngold. His scores for Of Human Bondage, The Seahawk, and King's Row are included in a new reissue of Korngold's work. Also, not punk, not quite new wave, not an art rock band, the British group Squeeze got together in the mid-70s and played pop. Squeeze is on an American tour with a new record. Coming up, we meet the two founding members, Chris Difford and Glenn Tilbrook. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers the hype we've gotten used to on book jackets. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A passenger ferry on its way to Great Britain from Hamburg, West Germany, collided with a container ship tonight at the mouth of the Elbe River. The accident occurred about 60 miles northwest of Hamburg, at the entrance to the North Sea. The BBC is reporting at least two people have been killed and several others were injured. Harbor police said the passenger ferry Hamburg was on its way to Harwich when it collided with the container ship Nordic Stream. A U.S. official said today that the Bush administration is greatly concerned that Israel may have transferred sensitive nuclear technology to South Africa. NPR's Anne Gerrels has this report.
The U.S. official, speaking on background to reporters at a seminar on arms control, said the United States does not know the extent of Israel's relationship with South Africa. But the official noted that technology used by South Africa in a missile test last summer exceeded Pretoria's known capability. The official also pointed to a South African fighter known as the Cheetah, noting it's virtually a mirror image of an Israeli plane. And questions were also raised about the transfer of technology relating to the Arrow anti-tactical ballistic missile. Because of concerns about Israel's military ties with South Africa, the official said the administration has delayed an Israeli request to purchase six supercomputers. But another U.S. official disputed this, saying Israel is undergoing nothing more than the normal review process. I'm Ann Gerrels in Washington.
On the eve of Nicaraguan peace talks at the UN, the government has offered to restore a ceasefire with the Contras if they agree to demobilize peacefully. President Ortega says the alternative for the Contras is to die in battle. David Adams reports.
President Ortega offered demobilization or death to the 10,000-strong Contra army. He said if the rebels rejected the latest Nicaraguan proposals, they would be voting for war. After dispatching a government delegation, which will meet the Contras tomorrow at the United Nations, Ortega unveiled the new proposals. If the Contras agree to disarm, Ortega said Nicaragua would restore a ceasefire which ended last week and allow Contra troops in Nicaragua to withdraw to their camps across the border in Honduras. Ortega also said that if agreement is reached, his government will temporarily suspend all arms imports until April next year. But Contra leaders say Ortega is bluffing. The rebels say they are in no hurry to sign any agreements with the Sandinistas, and they say they will not even consider disarming before Nicaraguan elections due to take place next February. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in Managua.
Southwest Bank of St. Louis cut its prime lending rate today down to 10% from 10.5%. The prime rate to which some business, consumer, and home equity loans are pegged has been at 10.5% since July 10th. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 26 points to close at 2,623. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Erich Wolfgang Korngold was a composer who was successful in two usually incompatible fields, concert music and movie music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of three new RCA compact disc reissues of music by Korngold.
The Viennese composer Erich Korngold was born in Czechoslovakia in 1897 and died 60 years later in Hollywood. In some circles, he's known mainly for his 1920 opera Die Tote Stadt, The Dead City, or at least one aria from it, Marietta's Song. The New York City Opera planned to revive it this year before its entire season was canceled after a dispute with the Musicians Union. Some people might remember the famous Jascha Heifetz recording of Korngold's 1945 Violin Concerto. But in other circles, Korngold is the composer of scores for such immensely entertaining Warner Brothers films as The Seahawk, The Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex, King's Row, or the two scores that won him Oscars, The Adventures of Robin Hood and Anthony Adverse. These were the lush musical canvases against which Errol Flynn, Betty Davis, John Garfield, Edward G. Robinson, even Ronald Reagan could emote. Except for Robin Hood, selections from all of these are on an album called The Classic Film Scores of Erich Wolfgang Korngold. Here's Charles Gerhardt conducting the exuberant suite from The Seahawk. This recording was made in the early 70s, but the new CD includes material the original LP didn't have room for. Victor has also reissued its 1975 recording of Korngold's Die Tote Stadt. This is a fascinating psychological romance about how the hero, Paul, recovers from the death of his beloved young wife, Marie. It's a cross between the grand opera religiosity of Meyerbeer and Vertigo, with dream sequences, passionate love scenes, and a holy procession. Paul finally re-enters the living world after nearly burying himself in the dead city of his grief. Erich Leinsdorf conducts the Munich Radio Orchestra. Soprano Carol Neblett sings the dual role of the cynical dancer Marietta and the dream vision of Marie. René Kollo is Paul. The cast also includes Hermann Pry and Benjamin Luxon. I wish the performance was a little peppier, more idiomatically Viennese. Still, for 2 hours, you can wallow in pure Korngold. For me, the big surprise is a third Korngold disc reissued by Victor. On it, the superb Chilingirian Quartet plays two Korngold string quartets, the first composed in 1923 and the third from 1945. Romantic, of course, and eclectic, they sound like Brahms and Dvorak, Debussy and Ravel, with an occasional nod toward modernism. They're more refined, but just as tuneful and almost as much fun as the movie scores. In fact, Korngold uses some of his own movie themes. The third movement of the third quartet, for instance, transforms a harmonica theme from the film of Jack London's The Sea Wolf into a poignant folk song. The remarkable thing about all these diverse Korngold pieces is how much they share the same sensibility. They may not be profound, but they're not hollow. They're inventive, beautifully crafted, and terrifically appealing works. The man knew what he was doing, and he did it with precision, skill, and great gusto.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed three new RCA reissues of music by Eric Korngold. This is Fresh Air. English songwriting team of lyricist Chris Difford and composer Glenn Tilbrook has been compared to Lennon and McCartney and Lieber and Stoller. Difford and Tilbrook have written and performed together since the mid-70s, when they formed the group Squeeze. Elvis Costello and John Cale each produced records by Squeeze. The band split up in 1982 and reformed in 1985. Squeeze is currently on a U.S. tour, performing songs from their new album, Frank. From Frank, this is The Last Time. About writing The Last Time?
Subject matter interested me because it's about how you can basically mess up relationships just through sort of being a bit of a slob. I don't know how you'd interpret that. Chris, perhaps you could give me your opinion.
I think that's a pretty good opinion, actually.
Glenn, what do you think about when you're handed a set of lyrics and are about to set a melody to it?
In an ideal world, as little as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I write Chris's lyrics, what I try and do is to not read them before I sit down in front of a piano and a guitar. I always sort of work on both whenever I'm doing a tune to one of Chris's lyrics. And if everything goes really, really sweetly, something will tumble out and it will all be over in half an hour and I'll be pleased with the result. Much more often than that, though, it's a process of actually sitting down and working. And I do try and keep to, you know, 7 or 8 hours a day of writing, because I think that if I look back over the most of the stuff that we've done, 90% of it has been something that has evolved through having worked at trying to get an idea and then the idea sparking off inspiration.
Glenn, you sing lead on The Last Time?
Yes, I sing lead for half the time, then Chris sings with me. We've got that sort of octave sound, Chris being the lower one.
How did you start singing that way? It's a distinctive sound that you've had, you know, on and off through all of your records, I think.
Well, it's one of those things that we actually stumbled on after we first started singing together, was that given any sort of known melody, and at the time we were playing quite a few other people's songs, that we'd gravitate towards a different octave. But it actually worked singing together that way, so we didn't really think about it, it just sort of happened that way.
So I guess your range is about an octave apart from each other too?
Pretty much so, yeah. Pretty much so, yeah.
You both stayed together after Squeeze broke up. Now Squeeze is back together again, but there was a period of time when you were just a duo. Why did you want to stay together when the other members of the group wanted to split?
Well, to be quite fair, I don't think the rest of the group did want to split at the time. I think it was Chris and I that decided that we'd had enough of the band, and we didn't really consult the rest of the members about it,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't entirely fair, but that's the way we did it at the time. having said that, I think the band did need to split up at that time. It was sounding a bit tired, and we'd been working for 5 or 6 years straight without really having any sort of breaks. And Chris and I didn't, I don't think we felt that we'd really exhausted our possibilities together, and we wanted to stay together and do some other things. So we went on and did a musical. We did our fabulously successful Difford and Tilbrook album, which at the time, about a quarter of an hour ago, I'm told, went triple platinum in the States. It'd been only double platinum up until now. That was a good couple of years, you know, where we sort of basically sat around South London rather than going on tour. And I think it's called recharging your batteries or getting a new loaf of bread or something.
You've been working together since, I think it's 1973. Can you tell the story of how you first met up?
Well, I met Glenn through putting an advert in a shop window for a guitar player to join a band, which was totally fictitious. There wasn't a band at all. And Glenn was the only person who answered the advert.
Some stiff competition.
Yeah.
Well, it was in a shop window alongside other cards selling things like, or saying things like, a kitten for sale or birthday cakes made. I mean, you wouldn't find many, I don't suppose, people looking in there for a job in the first place, because it was, normally if you're looking for people to join a band, if it's not word by mouth, then you put your name and details in the Melody Maker, English music press.
Well, why did you choose to put the ad up on this bulletin board that advertised for, you know, available kittens instead of going to the Melody Maker?
Because he's a complete weirdo. No other way around it. I mean, I've rung up and he said, all right, let's meet. And he said, I'll have a copy of this local paper underneath my arm. So I went looking for this guy with the local paper under his arm, and I saw him, but I thought, you know, why didn't he tell me he'd have a multicoloured Lurex coat on? That would be far easier to identify. But no, he stuck to the newspaper.
What kinds of bands had you both worked with before?
Well, I'd done some work with Jimi Hendrix and, and the Beatles and T-Rex particularly. They were good, but they're all on records in my bedroom. So, but no actual bands.
Really?
Yeah, really. No.
But I mean, both of you?
No, I had been in one band after leaving school, which was formed in the art class, and we used to play sort of songs that lasted about 20 minutes. And I remember getting some silver grease paint and putting it all over my face once, and then wearing a boiler suit to try and look like Pete Townsend.
Oh, that was just a couple of years ago.
And I sweated all the grease paint onto the bass because I was playing bass at the time, and of course my fingers just slipped on and off of the frets. Of course, nobody noticed at the time.
When you were first starting to record in the mid to late 70s, it was... Well, it was a period of punk rock in England, and you were playing pop. Did you feel like you were going against the grain of the time?
Let me think that one over now. Well, it's interesting because at the time that we first started doing gigs, 75 was when we sort of first got a series of dates, we were playing backup to bands that were... playing 20-minute songs, much like Chris's first band. You know, chaps in silver-painted faces and boiler suits trying to look like Pete Townsend. And the audiences would all be sitting on the floor, and we could never quite figure out why they'd do that. And we'd play our 3-minute songs. And admittedly, you know, I'm not painting an overly rosy picture. We'd play about 35 3-minute songs, but, you know, and by the 10th, they'd be bored, sick, and ready for the main band. But we never were into those sort of... We were always basically a pop band, I think.
Well, let me ask you about one of your early records. This is from 1978, Take Me, I'm Yours. What kind of sound were you going for then?
We were very interested at the time in getting some of the new technology in to work with. And if I remember rightly, nobody had any, so we had to hire in a guy who had some and knew how to use things. And... I remember Glenn would sit behind him and say, you know, we'd like this kind of rhythm and we'd like that kind of sequence. And he'd sort of, you know, spend about an hour pressing all these buttons and then the rhythm track would start.
It was basically hire everything we could possibly get in and then find a place to use it on. I remember particularly, if we're going to play Take Me Home Yours, listen to the guitar solo and think that I'm plugged into a Moog synthesizer. There's this man who's come in with all his equipment for a day, turning the knobs as I play. And I thought, it was a wonderful moment, lodged in my memory forever. Amusing belly dancers distract me from a wide across Tibetan mountains of memories of mine. I've stood some ghostly moments in natives in the hills, recorded here on paper, my chills and thrills and spills. Take me, I'm yours, because dreams are made.
You're on a tour of the States now. You've been on other tours of the States, and I'm sure you played here when your careers were just getting started at Squeeze. What's the difference between playing here now that you've been around for a few years and when you were getting started? Are you still playing the same kinds of places?
No, obviously we're not, because when we first came over here, we were playing, I remember we played two men and a dog in a club in Dover, New Jersey, and we were doing lots of clubs like that weren't really ready. Well, not ready for us, but I mean, they weren't, you know, they were used to having either country and western bands in, or bands that were doing cover versions of Baker Street or Kink songs or whatever, you know, Beatles songs. So we were playing those kind of bars. And now we've sort of graduated to colleges and which is what we're doing on this tour. And we're playing to four men and a dog now instead of three. And we're playing Madison Square Gardens for the third time, so we've sort of come up a bracket.
Well, I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you
very much.
Chris Difford and Glenn Tilbrook of Squeeze. Their new album, Frank, is on the A&M label. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're up to at All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello,
Terry. You covering
Terry.
Yesterday's election?
Sure are. Linda Wertheim will be talking to people about what this means, victories in New Jersey, Virginia, New York City. Is it a big Democratic sweep? Also, what it says about race and voting patterns in America today, that New York City has elected a black mayor for the first time, and more significantly, the state of Virginia, a former Confederate state, has elected the nation's first elected black governor. We'll also be hearing about elections in Jordan, in the Middle East, where women are voting for the first time. A talk with Jens Reich, leader of New Forum, the East German dissident movement, and all the fuss about talking over breakfast at the Savile Club in London.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Maybe you can't judge a book by its cover, but the people who write book cover blurbs won't stop trying to sell them that way. This point was brought home to linguist Jeffrey Nunberg recently when he was looking for a good read.
A number of years ago, Bruce J. Freeman wrote a charming story called The Big Six. The hero, Mr. Lorsey, has a job writing jacket copy for a publisher of paperback novels, and the secret of his success is that he always uses the word vortex somewhere in the blurb. Like, they were caught up in a vortex of twisted love and strange desires, two people at odds with a world they had never made. On one occasion, Mr. Lorsey actually risked using vortex twice in the same blurb. Their lives a vortex of panic and infidelity. The bed they slept in was a vortex of shame and lust. Mr. Lorsey fully expects that his boss will catch on and fire him for that one, but instead he's given a raise. The story came rushing back to me after all these years when I came home the other night with a kind of headache that makes even Jeopardy seem like an intellectual ordeal. I started sorting through my unread novels to find something to get me through to bedtime. The first thing I pulled down was the Bantam edition of Pat Conroy's Prince of Tides, which I recall somebody lending to me with a strong recommendation. I checked out the blurb on the back cover. Pat Conroy has created a huge, brash thunderstorm of a book, stinging with honesty and resounding with drama. Now, whenever you see a blurb that describes the publication as an adjective, adjective, noun of a novel, you know you're dealing with a novel that fairly cries out to be called a blockbuster. Ray Kinsella's Shoeless Joe, which was the basis for the movie Field of Dreams, was described by the L.A. Times as an utterly disarming, whimsical knuckler of a novel. Another way to tell you're dealing with this sort of novel is when you find strings of words connected by and with no commas. According to the Boston Globe, Russell Banks' Continental Drift covers the issues of race and dreams and love and sex and power and fantasy in America. When reviewers are not joining adjectives with and, they run to alliteration. For example, one reviewer described John Barth's Giles Goatboy as a big, bawdy, and boisterous blockbuster of a book. This is as impressive in its way as Mr. Lorsey's Double Vortex. Publishers naturally like the word bawdy, which means that the book has lots of funny scenes with redeeming literary merit. When the sex scenes aren't particularly funny, you say that the book is provocative or searing. In fact, vortex is only one of what must be hundreds of English words that have been saved from extinction only by the assiduous efforts of blurb artists. Where, besides on the dust jacket of a book, are you likely to see anything described as a mirthful, rollicking romp? Or see an author described as a haunting and lyrical new voice in American letters? And why does every review of an Ann Tyler novel end with, and above all, true? Doesn't she make them all up out of her own head? But as I said, I had this towering, blistering blockbuster of a headache, so I finally went to bed with The Sun Also Rises. It was a copy I'd bought at a garage sale, the first paperback edition published by Bantam in 1949. The jacket copy says, "Brawny Jake Barnes wanted only one thing, Brett Ashley, but neither she nor any woman could ever be his. It was truly a rotten way to be wounded." It goes on, "Only Hemingway, master of unspoken secrets, could successfully tackle this daring theme. Only Hemingway, greatest of realists, could weave this shattering novel of dissipation and passion and pleasure-mad novel." Well, it didn't live up to its jacket copy, but it wasn't half bad.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a sizzling, fiery barn burner of a linguist. He's associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air. Research assistance from Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, biologist Stephen Jay Gould challenges the commonly held belief that evolution is a logical march of progress. Also, anthropologist Richard Nelson tells us about his time on an island in the Pacific Northwest where there's an abundance of wildlife, but absolutely no other people. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.